came up with this idea to do this medical panel and talking about all these advances in the surgeries and rehab and everything, which don't just affect major league players, but you know also allow me to play softball twice a week after going through a couple of the procedures myself. The first person that I thought of that I wanted to moderate this panel was Will Carroll. His Under the Knife column has really been the benchmark for the injury reporting in the last several years. And he's you can see it now at SI.com. And I'm going to let him introduce the rest of the panel and turn it over to him.
Thanks, Steve. First, let me say I'm honored to be here, honored to be asked, and thank you, Steve, for inviting me and being far too kind with your introduction. What we're really here to hear is from some of the best experts in sports medicine, so let me introduce them quickly. To my immediate left is Ned Burgert, now with Physiotherapy Associates. He is the former head trainer for how many years?
21.
21, and you were with them longer than that.
36. Though.
Yeah, with the Angels of wherever they're calling themselves now. Ned was one of the most highly rated trainers under any statistics, and his World Series ring is proof of that. To his left is Dr. Neil Elitrosh. He's Director of Sports Medicine at the Curlin Job Orthopedic Clinic, one of the most famed hospitals for sports in the world. He's also the team orthopedist for the Los Angeles Dodgers. And when anybody in the world hurts a knee or a shoulder, that's the guy they look at. The first time I ever saw Neil, it was at a panel, and Jim Andrews was asked, what does he do when he gets a shoulder injury consult? And he said, the first thing he does is call Neil Elitrosh. To his left is Kevin Wilk. Kevin's from Champion Sports Medicine in Birmingham, Alabama. His title escapes my mind right now, so Kevin, if you'll... Clinical Associate...
Yeah, Associate Clinical Director is fine.
There you go. He is responsible for some of the rehabs of so many athletes we couldn't even list. It's mind-boggling, the work he's done and the work of people he's worked with, such as Mike Reinhold, now the head trainer for the Boston Red Sox, has changed the way that both baseball and sports in general have rehab. So to start this off, my first question, and I'll start with you, Ned. Why is sports medicine and the medical staff itself so undervalued in baseball?
Well, I think several things. One is that we're kind of taken for granted. We've always been a fixture in sports, and especially baseball. And just people just kind of say, you know, you're there, you do your job, you do it quietly, and move on. We're not a very vocal group. We're very caring and giving bunch, as athletic trainers are, and physicians and physical therapists. And I think we just kind of try to blend into the woodwork.
With all the money that we're spending on athletes, in the last decade, owners have lost $1 billion or more to the disabled list. And that's to say nothing of players that come back at less than states. Of course, none of you guys come back at less than states. Does it surprise you that owners haven't grasped onto this in a sport where we're paying $5-6 million to sign a 16-year-old from Latin America? There's no medical staff that has a medical budget of $1 million. Does that surprise you, Neil?
You know, I think that maybe...
Oh, that's a little hot.
More a reflection of our society. You know, the players we take care of are technically work comp players. And so that's the, it's just a reflection of it. It's a microcosm of medical care in the country. We just happen to be taking care of a lot of high-priced, well-known people. But more and more, recently. There are now there's a fund now that's funding research through Major League Baseball, and there's a research committee set up now that is starting to look at some of the issues. Baseball has been a little bit behind the NFL with regard to getting this kind of thing underway in injury registry, so that we know who's getting injured, what kind of injuries they're getting. Believe it or not, that's not widely known. We have no way to communicate medical records with each other until just now it's starting to be done this year. So it is starting to become much more recognized, and they're starting to put some money into research. Will mentioned the amount of money that is at stake on the disabled list. And if you count the amount of money of the player's salaries and the replacement salaries, it's mind-boggling. It's $450 million a year. That's an enormous amount of money, so it doesn't take you many years to... And if you look at what's going on right now with the finances of the teams, it's really hard to figure out why they don't value this a bit more, but actually I think that's changing with the money at stake. So.
But even so, that Major League Fund is still under $1 million that they've granted out, and $451 million. It surprises me that they're not doing more. Kevin, over the last 10 years, 20 years, we've seen amazing changes in the rehabs and the surgeries, and as Albert Pujols has shown, in the recovery times. What have been some of the biggest changes you've seen over that time period?
Well, I think the change in rehab is reflective of the surgical techniques. As they enhance, these individuals that have had surgery, we're able to move them quicker, perhaps load tissue a little bit faster, so the recovery is faster. Also, athletes are in better shape today than they were years ago. So consequently, if you're in better shape going into an injury, theoretically, you should be able to come back a little bit faster. And from a rehabilitation standpoint, we're a team just like a team is on the playing field. The orthopedic surgeon, the athletic trainer, the physical therapist, hopefully work in a nice homogeneous kind of common theme as far as returning this player back. So, for instance, like Dr. Eltrush may do surgery, hand them over to the trainer or physical therapist, explains the surgical technique, the do's and don'ts, and based on that, because obviously the physician knows the tissue, knows the person, their own unique healing properties, and therefore we can expedite the rehab. So I think, our knowledge of the particular injuries, the stresses that are imparted afterwards, have all allowed us to expedite the whole process. So,
I know as a rehab professional, as a physical therapist, you get in after the process, but most of these cases, at least the athletics, I know you deal with a lot more than just athletes, are you taking a look at the kind of player they are? And Neil, does that affect the surgery? I mean, knowing what, a power pitcher versus a junk ball pitcher or an older pitcher as opposed to, say, a younger prospect.
Yeah, the biggest difference would be if you look at a position player versus a guy that's a DH and a pitcher. I mean, if you have shoulder issues, you're going to treat them subtly differently because their requirements are different in their shoulder. If you limit rotation at all in a pitcher, you're going to negatively affect velocity by definition. It's going to be a far different pitcher. Whereas if it's a lead shoulder and a hitter, where you see batter shoulder, you can go ahead and tighten that as well as you can, and you're not going to change the way that guy hits. So you need to know the mechanics of the that are necessary in the player that you're taking care of. So the same injury in two different position players will be treated subtly differently. That takes a while. It takes some experience and a while for us to learn that. But I think we understand a little bit more about the requirements of some of these positions.
I know Dr. Andrews always tells the famous story about Tom Candiotti. I believe, Kevin, you probably know this one. He came in and said he needed Tommy John, and he said, you know, do you really want to do this? Are you a prospect? And Candiotti said, well, yeah, I'm a prospect, which he actually wasn't if you go back and look it up. Had surgery and obviously had a great major league career. How much are you able to pass judgment on players, Ned? You know, when you're looking at how much time and effort you're going to put in, how much more focus do the stars get? Or are you doing, I mean, obviously you're going to do your best to give everybody care, but do you ever focus more on that superstar player or keeping Vlad Guerrero's back healthy over, say, you know, some guy who's just up from the minors?
Well, you know, as a healthcare provider, when a player becomes injured, they become our patient. So we have to give them our full attention, whether they're the 25th guy on the roster or the number one player on the team, you have to give equal time to it. Do you give time, more time to the superstar? Possibly in the end, but you're trying to get everybody healthy on that team and in the minor leagues, because you never know when that person's going to be out there and drive in a winning run or come in the eighth inning and put a hold situation on for your stopper can come in and hold the game. So, you know, everybody's of equal importance in the baseball.
With the time constraints and the staff constraints and not so much the resource constraints at the major league level, how do you apportion your time? If you have a run of injuries, do you reduce the time you're spending on preventive care or, you know, stretching or, you know, working on something that a guy just needs maintenance? How does that affect your day-to-day time planning?
It makes the day a heck of a lot longer. well, what we did is we had a system where the non-starters would come in beginning at 1 o'clock in the afternoon for a 7 o'clock game. Then if the guys were starting, they'd start coming in like at 3 o'clock. And then pitchers, and we had a system that we worked through. Essentially, the previous day starting pitcher would come in and get with the strength coach, go do his distance run the afternoon after he pitched, and then go through his upper body lift, and then come up in the third inning, and we do our manual therapy with him. And then he'd go through his rotator cuff program. So we had that apportioned. The relief pitchers, depending on the guy, we do them closer to the game. The guys that would be the long guys, we'd work on them like about 6:30 so they could get out to the game at 7, be out in the bullpen. So when that starter got hurt warming up, there was actually somebody in the bullpen. But you just like a regular clinic schedule, you set it up and try to proportion it the best you can.
With most teams have a staff of three, where there's two trainers and a team physician. And there's obviously other associated people. Neil, do you feel like that's enough? And do you feel like you're able to call in all the resources that are needed to make sure that you're not shortchanging someone in that kind of situation?
Yeah, that's not enough. It might be the basic bare bones staff, but most teams now they have at least access to a physical therapist that's not a full-time therapist on the staff now. And so you'll have the head trainer, assistant trainer, and then a specialty therapist that are involved. And also then you'll have your specialty consultants as well. So you'll have, you know, an eye doctor, you'll have all the different types of specialty trained physicians as well. But the day-to-day people, generally it's being run more than just the trainer and the assistant trainer. You guys, the teams that you've helped to staff, generally they have a physical therapist on
at least a resource so they can be referred out. like with Tampa, for instance, we have a couple therapists in the local area. Just like Ned's saying, it becomes a time management, especially if it's a big injury, big surgery, you've got a lot of guys on the DL or a lot of things going on. They can farm those out for a while and then bring them back, especially when there's sports specific training on the field. So, you know, like at our center, we can't do a lot of throwing. We can't do things like that. So we can unload the athletic trainer and kind of budget our time a little bit more effectively and then hand them back over to a Ned or their trainer so they can do field stuff. So I think that's the best scenario sometimes. Sometimes players, a little bit time away is actually somewhat good, and then they come back into the mainstream.
It's important, though, to have for the players to know that they have access to a wide array of really top-level people, because otherwise you're going to see what has happened with some high-profile players where they start to bring in their own people. And that was a big problem back in the late 90s and early 2000s, because the people they brought in, you had no idea what they were coming from. And so you had, you know, illicit drug use, and you had the different types of treatments and therapies that were being rendered that you had no control over. So you want to have the players comfortable with your level of expertise of your staff. Even then, you're going to get some rogue guys, and I'm sure we can touch on some of the issues. But you're going to, even then, you're going to have some guys that say, "Well, this is my guy," and have him in the corner of the locker room. But you want to try to preempt that and have the best available for your players.
Now, that leads perfectly into my next question, which is, when you have a player, obviously, Ned, when a guy went down on the field, you were right there. You were taking care of him in the immediate situation. The doctor would then step in, whether it was Neil or Dr. Yoakum with the Angels, and he would take that and maybe take it to surgery if it was necessary. And after that, he would send him on to someone like Kevin. How do you integrate that approach, especially in an era where a lot of teams or a lot of players and agents will seek a second opinion or that they want to rehab at home or with their own guys?
Well, I was very fortunate that Louis Yoakum, who was our team physician, was basically the person that they sent him to, either to Dr. Andrews or to Dr. Yoakum, for that second opinion. So it was very seldom that we had a player go out and get him. You would walk him down the hall to see Dr. Joe when he was practicing, or down the hall to see Neil to you know, get that second opinion. So that was kind of in-house.
Yeah.
But it becomes a matter of trust and a matter of putting your medical staff, has been alluded to, but everybody having the same philosophy and on the same page. And probably one of the biggest things that we found is with our strength and conditioning coaches, they were very good at what they did, but probably didn't have a great understanding of what an athletic trainer physical therapist did. So we got them together with the athletic trainers in the minor leagues and the major league, and we'd sit down in spring training and we get on the same verbiage and the same terminology. And so there's a seamless transition moving from the training room to the weight room and then onto the field. So that was very helpful for us.
Now, Kevin, you get them often there in Birmingham. They're obviously off-site, unless they're a double-A player. How do you communicate with the teams, and how do you have to integrate since you see so many different athletes from so many different teams? Is that a challenge?
Yeah, definitely, because the communication is multiple levels now. It's totally changed in the last 10 years. Before, it would be just contact Ned, say, here's what we found, you know, this is what we suggest. But you always want to work closely with each team. You don't want to alienate. You don't want to make it a, you know, this is like a dogmatic approach. This is a way to do it. You want to integrate in your philosophy with the philosophy of the organization, because a lot of the organizations have different philosophies, returning the throw and things of that nature. So you don't want to be too cavalier about it. But the other aspect of that is, I think if you're all on the same page and the player sees that, you have a common theme, as Ned mentioned, a common philosophy, and you don't get those players kind of spinning off in another direction. So for me, we set them up. We tell them we're pretty open as far as with the athletic trainer, what we think from a rehabilitation standpoint. But unfortunately, the last few years, you know, a lot of agents get involved, and the agents want to hear from you. And is the team doing the right thing? And in your opinion,
you know, what should happen, and that's when things get a little touchy at times, you know, because you have to really be careful on how you progress.
Is that situation the same for you, Neil? Because you obviously see players from teams other than the Dodgers. A lot of people don't understand that, you know, when you're on the road, the home team doctors take care of them, but you also do it on a consulting basis. Is that difficult to integrate?
Well, you know, I learned from the people that raised me in orthopedics were really, really good at it. And it comes from a position of really sincerity and honesty. And so, you know, if you deliver your input as and you view it as you're part of the healing team or whatever, and you don't, it's not about you. It's not you check your ego at the door and you just play whatever role you need to play and communicate with whoever as far as making sure that the priority is that the player comes first, whatever the player may need. Then everything else takes care of itself. In this day and age of, you know, media spotlight and physicians aren't immune to having, you know, egos but when that starts to play some role on the priority list higher than it should be, then that's where guys get into trouble. And so, I think that Ned put it best, you know, when a player comes to you injured, they're your patient. And that takes priority over everything. And so you play whatever role you need to play to get that guy better, whether it's just, you know, comforting the guy and confirming that the opinion that he had with his team physician was correct, or whether it's offering your own opinion that may be different because they really can't figure out the diagnosis or whatever that might be. But you just need to make sure that your priorities are correct, and it's getting that guy better. That's the number one priority.
Ned, how tough is it to get the player on board and understanding the process? Obviously, besides Bobby Brown, there's no doctors in baseball that I know of. Especially when it's a younger player, a player whose English might not be as strong as some, or a player who has an injury that's threatening his very career. How do you deal with that?
Well, you just sit down with them, and honestly, you become kind of that father figure as an athletic trainer to the players, especially in the minor leagues, where, you know, you sit down, you listen, you just become that person that they can talk to and share with you, and you develop a trusting relationship, and that starts, again, down in the minor leagues, and as those players develop within your system, the word spreads quickly that, you know, it's a solid group of people that are taking care of you and can help you get better. That's how you do it.
Do you have to obviously you have to build that relationship. Is that difficult? Has it changed over time as the money's gotten bigger, as free agents have come through? You've seen that over the course of your career. Has the trust broken down at all, or is that more reliant on the professional to build up that relationship before it's even necessary?
I don't think the trust is broken down. I think you have many more outside forces, which was alluded to earlier. The agents, you know, trying to look out for the player's best interest. And is it really the agent's best interest at times that, you know, they're the one that's going to carry the banner off? But essentially, it's, you know, you're in this community, this family of essentially 50 people in that traveling party. And you have to trust each other and care for each other. And it's one big family because you're together basically 24/7.
And you guys are three of the leading lights in sports medicine. You understand both the on-field and the off-field, the medical side, the financial side. The problem is, with all the advances we've made, with all the work that we've done, just in the past 10 years, the changes have been amazing. The things we're able to do for these players, the way we're able to get them back, bigger, stronger, faster, very literally, yet we're not able to prevent injuries any better. It seems like, at least on the surface, DL days, dollars lost, have, if anything, gone up. Why? Kevin?
I think that's one of the things that have been going on in Birmingham for the last 10 years. Actually, we just published a paper, a 10-year study on youth baseball. Obviously, it starts at the youth level and hopefully can work its way up the chain to high school, college, and professionals. A little bit of a different animal, obviously. But I think we do have more information about why people get hurt. We're starting to unravel. It's so multi-faceted, though. But we're starting to unravel some of the range of motion things that are happening with the thrower's shoulder, rest, pitch types, and probably a lot of these problems that have manifested themselves at the major league level or professional level probably started at a pretty young age. Some of the motion things and so forth, you know, as far as shoulder range of motion and the characteristics that you see. So I think we've gotten better at actually figuring out injuries. We haven't certainly figured out. I think people are on the DL more. I mean, I'm a little bit of an outsider. I don't have day-to-day operations with a pro team like these two gentlemen do. So I see the injuries. We analyze them. We have relationships with teams. And I think, you know, you look at pitch types. You look at ball velocity nowadays. You look at the size of pitchers. You look at the number of exposures, the inability to rest, the competition level for dollars. All those things come into play at the big league level. So you're playing hurt more often. You're coming back, especially during contractual years in particular. And overall, I mean, we study this in our biomechanics lab. Throwers today are different than they were years ago. So consequently, you're generating much more torque. And you have to develop specialty pitches or be a more proficient thrower. So it would stand the reason you'd see probably more days on the DL. You see more injuries and so forth. It's kind of an unfair comparison, you know, decade to decade. But again, as I mentioned, I think we're starting to unravel a little bit better.
Neil, I know you have thoughts on this.
I was actually anxious to ask you your opinion on it because I don't have the answer. I have some suspicions as things that lead to it. You know, if you look at the and we're talking to a very sophisticated audience with regard to baseball research here, but for those of you that have looked at this trend, you see that if you measure our performance medically in DL days, I don't think we're doing well. But I, on the other hand, I don't think that that's a valid way to judge what we're doing medically. Unable to perform days might be a little bit better way to look at it. And there are statistics with regard to that. But if you look at DL days, there was a 4 to 5% increase in DL days from the late 90s until about 2004, 2005. And you saw a little dip that the number of DL days went down significantly, about 15-18%, and now it's creeping back up again. And if you look into the factors that go into the disabled list, a lot of them are not medical related. It's roster related, and so you know how do you manage a roster over the course of a season? You know?
There's definitely about a 4% wastage on years where it's phantom DL moves, worse at the minor league level.
But the interesting thing is, if you break down the DL days, those phantom moves, the quote fake DL, or that would reflect itself in the short term DL, the 15 day mm-hmm. DL, right? If you look at the number of DL days over 120 days, that's actually gone up. And so it's not the short-term DL as much that you could sort of attribute that. So what's happening? And I think that three things might be going on. Number one, you're seeing possibly the naked truth of what baseball does to a player in their late 20s and early 30s, because now you're seeing less guys on HGH and steroids. And so I think that what's happening is that the wear and tear is taking a toll on those guys. And so you're seeing guys break down now that after the Bonds era, where people said, well, there must be something to this. And a lot of guys, I think, went that direction. You saw that they were able to maintain their function with regard to wear and tear injuries that take a heck of a long time. Once they become really symptomatic, it takes a long time to get those guys better. And you're seeing those more exposed now. So that may be one. The other thing is that we do have better surgical techniques now to fix guys that we weren't fixing before. Well, if I take a guy that's in his early 20s and I fix what's torn in his shoulder, he's going to end up on the DL for more than 120 days. That's a lost season. Yeah. So the more willing we are to do that, the more we understand about what can be done, the longer the DL days are for those kinds of guys. And it remains to be seen if we're going to be getting more of those guys back.
Well, it's obvious that just in Tommy John numbers, you know, we're getting those guys back. 30 years ago now, those guys would be selling insurance or pumping gas or whatever it was they were going to do after baseball. Shoulder, even more so, just in the last 10 years. I can remember some of the statistics we had at the injuries in baseball conference back 8-9 years ago, and the difference now. You have something else to add, Kevin?
Yeah, to dovetail on Neil's point is we just published a paper on this, one team, 3 years of data of injuries. The major league injuries take 3 times longer on the DL than minor league. Mm-hmm. And that could be reflective of a lot of different variables. Maybe just administrative, maybe the
7-day DL versus 15.
Yeah, exactly. But I think recognition, and you hit it on the head as well, recognition of the injury is different today than it was years ago. Everybody's better at identifying, and also risk factors for further injury, the second injury. Like when you look at, again, I don't want to dwell on youth baseball because I'm not quite sure everybody's interested in that, but when you look at youth baseball throwers between the ages of 9 and 14, 50 to 60% are going to get hurt. They're going to complain of elbow or shoulder pain when they're pitching. The problem is the second injury. A third of them are going to get injured again. So you wonder if that's just not a way that they kind of deal with this problem at a young age, this repeated insult and so forth. So by the time they get to a high school level, college, or even professional, they've already conditioned themselves. They're going to hurt. They're going to keep getting re-injured, and obviously something devastating can happen as a result of that.
Well, what do you think is going on?
I think it's you guys are so much better at getting them back that we're willing to take use Jason Schmidt as an example. That's a guy who years ago would have just been pat on the back, old watch, here you go. I don't think he would have to sell insurance. He did okay financially. I do think also the replacement cost has gotten a lot bigger. It used to be that players were cheap, and even the cheap players aren't that cheap anymore. So I think the difference between a Jason Schmidt and a Robbie De La Rosa is still pretty massive. And I think you're much more willing to try to see whether or not you can get a guy back. We see cases over and over of people that are signed basically on hope contracts. Guys like Brandon Webb. And some of them come back, and some of them don't. And I think you see those extended DL stints, and there's the occasional payoff. And when it pays off big. It's like hitting the jackpot. One for you, Ned, and this is one that I'm sure you've studied extensively. Why the heck are we having all these oblique injuries?
Yeah. Oh, gosh. If I knew that answer, I wouldn't be right here. So, there's a lot of factors. I don't know if we look at the guys that we had in the past with the oblique injuries, we're seeing a lot of pelvic rotation. So everybody does something to one side, and their pelvis gets out of alignment. Work in the weight room, where they just keep going, working into that same pattern of dysfunction. And so I think that's part of it. I think some of it's a lot of the travel that guys are getting on airplanes, curled up as a little pretzel in the airplane, and then sleep deprived, to get dehydrated, the oblique, you go fire that oblique to hit or throw, and it pops on you.
All of you guys have had a great career so far, and certainly many more years to come. What's been the biggest change you've seen? I'll start with you, Ned.
Probably the quality of the sports medicine team in general. It used to be when I first started that the gentleman who was a head trainer there was an ex-boxer, and he was a friend of somebody and got the job, and he had great hands and, you know, could, you know, rub, and that was it. Now, you know, we have most of the athletic trainers in Major League Baseball and Minor League Baseball have their masters, highly educated, you know, very in tune with what's going on. Physicians are more in tune with sports medicine in general. When Dr. Curlin and Dr. Job started, it was just, that was in its infancy, and now it's really expanded. And the diagnostic techniques of having MRIs and arthroscopic surgery, it's just exploded, and it's kept moving forward.
Neil?
Yeah, I think that the level of care from the ancillary people, as well as the physicians, but the level of understanding from therapists and trainers, and the level of sophistication of and medical understanding of the players too. I mean, you guys all, it's sort of common vernacular. There's probably not anybody in this room that doesn't know what a Tommy John operation is. And so, you know, the overall level of understanding has exploded. And I think it's across the board. It's not just the physicians. It is the team. I agree with Ned. And I think that that's been probably the biggest change since I've been at it. There was just maybe a small core of people that were working on it, and the guys that really knew what we didn't know. Those are the important guys. The real smart ones know the answers that we don't have, and there's a lot of them, by the way. But that core of people has expanded, and it's across the board.
In the area of rehab, I'd say, you know, it's allowed us these advances in surgery, immediate motion. Years ago, you had to mobilize somebody. Tommy John was immobilized after his UCL. So now we've moved people almost right away. So the effects of immobilization are minimized. So in my world in rehab, you know, I'm a pushing an envelope kind of guy. So that's why I get along with the athletes a lot of times, is because they want to be pushed. So even though we may not be pushing, we give the illusion at least we're pushing with immediate motion, immediate strengthening. So they're going. The other thing I would say is the exercises have changed. You know, and then when you first started, I mean, they were pretty, you know, the philosophy was lightweight. Don't get too heavy. Don't get bulky. Don't let a thrower get too big. That philosophy has changed. Now it's a better athlete, not just the thrower, but it's a better athlete. We use plyometrics. We do a lot of exercises that were never used 30 years ago or 40 years ago. So there's been a whole evolution, not only in the surgery, the acute care, but also the rehabilitation. And those are just a couple.
Let's start with you on the next question, Kevin. What's the most exciting thing you see coming in the next 20 years?
Hopefully retirement. A lottery ticket. But next 20 years, you know, that's hard to say. I mean, I guess some of the things that are happening from a surgical standpoint, you know, the biggest issue, and probably Neil can comment on this, is I think the elbows we have, I don't want to say we have worked out, I don't want to be that egotistical about it, but the elbows, you know, we're pretty good at elbows, getting 85 to 90% of the people back. Shoulders, cuff, oh my God, I know that's a passion of yours. That's the biggest problem for me to rehab. Somebody has a cuff problem in a thrower. Doesn't matter if it's, you know, a small percentage, but once it starts to break down, and you get 25% or more of a penetrating lesion or an interstitial tear, you've got a huge problem on your hands. I don't really worry about, you know, slaps are another issue, but, you know, slaps, I'm getting better with those, I think, personally. I've got a pretty good success rate with slaps. But when there's slaps with cuffs, and Neil published a great paper on this, that's a big-time problem, especially in somebody who's breaking down and has repeated breakdowns.
Could you quickly explain what you just said?
The lottery ticket part?
No, just to make sure we don't lose anybody with slaps and interstitials.
Oh, okay, yeah, slaps. You want to? Maybe you should.
He wrote the paper. So. The two main problems that a thrower has is, one, stability. And the stability is governed by cartilage structures. The socket of the ball and socket joint in the shoulder is surrounded by a bumper of cartilage that goes all the way around. And that provides depth, a break stop, and also provides attachment for some of the important structures that stabilize the shoulder. So the ball doesn't fly willy-nilly back and forth whenever somebody's trying to generate velocity throwing the ball. And the other thing then is the dynamic stabilizers, and that's the rotator cuff. And so Kevin's right. If you have a shoulder with an isolated problem to that cartilage bumper, the labrum, we're pretty good at getting that thing fixed without over-tightening the shoulder, getting it to heal, and getting that guy rehabbed back. And the rehab has been excellent with that. When they have a cuff tear, and if the cut, it's a, number one, it's a main pain generator. That's where a lot of the pain comes from. And when you fix that rotator cuff, you have to deal with two things. Number one, it's a notoriously slow healing tissue. And number two, it's under enormous amount of torque and strain whenever you get them moving. And so how do you get them moving in a short enough time that the game doesn't pass them by? And right now, I think that's our main problem. I think that the labrum heals in about, if you look at the biologic healing of the labrum, the cartilage bumper, 12 to 16 weeks, you've got biologic healing good enough that you can start to apply a significant amount of torque on that cartilage. The cuff takes so much longer, and the cuff doesn't care when opening day is, doesn't care when the All-Star break is, and I think that the arbitrary dates that we have in mind for these guys to come back from something like a rotator cuff repair is what's beating us. The game just does not wait long enough for a player to come back from a cuff repair yet. And so I think one of the most exciting things that's going to come along is how we can modify and manipulate the biology of healing to speed that process up. And I think that with stem cell technology, you know, using blood products that we're starting to understand now that can accelerate these things, that's where we're going to be able to hopefully keep a lot of guys out of the operating room, because if they're in these guys' hands, they fare a lot better than if they're in my hands, quite honestly. And so if we can keep them out of the operating room, or heaven forbid they do get into the operating room, if we can manipulate the biology of healing so that the game doesn't pass these guys by and they're stuck rehabbing and they no longer have a career, if we can speed that up, and I think that's what's most exciting if we look at what's happening with us. It's actually not with the knife, it's in the test tube.
Can I say one thing real fast on the cuff before Ned comments? Cuff repair is done in Dr. Andrew's hands in baseball players. I'm embarrassed to say the results, 10% made it back to play. 10%. 1 out of 10. That's pathetic. And that's not because it's not a good surgeon. One of the best in the world. It's just, it's a tough animal to get back.
I have a professional catcher who, I thought that I did a masterful job on his rotator cuff. It was maybe in early September, and had my the dates pegged where if he got his motion back and could get him throwing, I had All-Star break pegged for his first rehab start. Well, he had a little different idea. His date for not a rehab start, but a Major League Baseball game was opening day, April 1. And he played for another team, didn't play for my team, so that it was not in my day-to-day control as much, but he cruised through spring training, no pain, and I started to get nervous. As soon as I heard that, what he was doing, I started to get really nervous, because I knew biologically there was no way that this repair would hold up, because he was depending on my embroidery rather than God's gluing of the tissues together. And so my stitches would only hold up so much. And right around the last week of March, he started to have a little bit of pain. He's a position player and dove into a base. And so got an MRI scan, part of the repair had peeled off. So then he went back to throwing, just got an MRI scan recently, and he pulled off the front corner. That front corner is so important. So the rest of the, I'd say probably 75% of my repair is healed. 25% is pulled off. It's the part that's under the most strain. You know, he's not going to be able to throw without pain. So the cuff is very unforgiving. It doesn't heal quick, and you know that's the bane of my existence right now, because that's what I take care of a lot. So,
have to agree with Dr. Elitrosh that the biologics that are coming down, the PRP and the stem cell, is just a new frontier that is still, you know, is that going to push everybody over the edge, or are you going to use that and then find that the tissue is not quite responding? The couple players that we used it with, what was really interesting with it is when we gave them the PRP injections is we had them rest, except for daily living activities, and that rest, just letting that tissue naturally heal and mend, was very beneficial instead of us trying to push them through and accelerate their rehab program. And they got back fine and haven't had any problems since. The other thing that I think is on the horizon, which is, has been ongoing, is the collection of data. You know, we probably had about 10 years of looking at not only shoulder internal external rotation, but also hip internal rotation and ankle motion, and looking to see how that correlates to injury. And we saw a huge pattern of people who would have elbow or shoulder problems who the opposite side of the hip would be limited in rotation. And so especially either hitters or pitchers that we would see that. And also ankle motion, if that was locked up, became a solid lever so the person couldn't function properly and more stress was put on. So just more awareness of that and more looking at the total athlete and not just worrying about, you know, the upper extremity thing.
We've got about 10 minutes more, but I'd like to open up the floor to your questions. If you have them, just there's a mic there. Or...
Yes, just a quick question. With the Tommy John surgery, and it's said that players come back and they can throw harder than they had ever been able to.
No.
Is that true? And if it is true, how is that true?
Can I take this one?
Yeah.
No, it's not true. I actually talked to, I had an interview 2 years ago with Frank Jobe and Tommy John, which was just a phenomenal experience. The way Frank explained it was that all he's doing is returning them back to health. We didn't know how hurt they were. The example I always use is Andy Pettit, a player who never had Tommy John surgery. But he had elbow problems, and he also had shoulder problems. But if you went back and saw what his genetic maximum might have been and what we saw him at, even though he was able to be effective, we probably only saw 85-90%. So what you're getting is a player that A, is completely repaired. He's had a year off, essentially. He's done rehab. He's thought about nothing but pitching. He's been in Kevin's hands for a long period of time, and he's been dealing with his mechanics, everything else. So when he comes back and throws a little bit faster than he was before, normally what we're seeing is a 2-mile-an-hour gain. And that's a very small sample size of pitch effects. We're not seeing that. It's more pronounced in kids, but again, we're seeing there's a bigger variance there, and also kids have such a wide variance in their performance to begin with.
Hey, Will, you know where that came from, right? Steve Carson.
Yes.
With the Cleveland Indians, when he blew his elbow out, just like you said, his velocity was dropping as his elbow was going. He had the UCL done by Dr. Andrews. He came back, his velocity was up by about 4 miles
yep.
per hour. So he had an SI story where he said, the Tommy John made me throw faster. So then kids started coming in the clinic and seeing Dr. Andrews and probably Dr. Elitrosh as well, saying, I got a little bit of elbow pain. Can you just tighten up my ligament? I want to be able to pick up 4 or 5 miles per hour faster. And Dr. Andrews has spent hours and hours finding kids out of this surgery. They don't really need the surgery that they can throw harder, become a better athlete. Just like Ned was saying, it's a kinetic chain. 60-70% of the force comes from your legs and the trunk. So if you want to throw better, use the kinetic chain.
Thank you. That sort of leads into a question that I wanted to ask about ethics. I don't even know how to frame the question, so I'll just give you an example that you're not going to be able to comment on, but maybe you can comment on ethics. About a month ago, the Marlins were ready to send Coughlin down to New Orleans and announced it. And the very next day, an injury appeared. They had a consultation with the team doctor, and he went on the disabled list instead of going to the minor leagues. That, of course, had a major financial implication to his salary. So I'm curious to know how often ethical issues arise. I know your answer is going to be you're always on the side of the ethic, but how often does it come up?
Well, that particular case is interesting because that's my patient, so I can't really comment
on
it. I'll let Neil handle that.
Well, just like it's hard to ask the question, it might be hard to answer. It always comes up. And so the best organizations are the ones that let the doctor be a doctor and let the business of baseball take a different course, separate course. Now, having said that, you'll see people that just exactly in that kind of situation, because of the roster, they're going to say, okay, we need to have, I think it'd be best for him to take a rest because this or that is ailing him. That's one thing for them to say. It's a whole different thing for them to get one of the medical professionals on board to actually dictate a note that says that. I can tell you that we don't do it. I would bet my bottom dollar Lou never did it. So their baseball decisions have to be what they are, separate from us. Now, I will tell you, that's coming under scrutiny. There is now an injury registry that's just started this year, and they're going to look at this, and they're going to need to have medical documentation when people go on the DL, more than just, it's supposed to be there, but now it's going to be looked at by an independent committee. So I think it will come under more scrutiny. It's always an issue, to answer your question.
I think one of the things that we're seeing with situations like that is one that we often see in the minor leagues, where at the end of the year, when the players are suddenly going to be on their own, not being paid, especially minor league players who aren't making very much, they suddenly come up with an injury. Where they've had, I've had this all season long, I've been dealing with it, because then they get workers' compensation, a lot of other situations. In a situation, I don't know if that's true with Coughlin, but a player has been playing hurt. He's not told the trainers, and suddenly when he realizes he's about to get sent down, he goes, it's this thing. I'm sure you guys have all had type of situation.
In a hypothetical situation, too, the player is playing hurt, the trainer's keeping him on the field, and all of a sudden his performance starts to go down to a level that's unacceptable, but he does have an injury, and perhaps can be treated at the major league level better. I'm not saying that's the case with him, but theoretically that happens
all the time.
All the time, exactly. So let's say a player gets down to Birmingham, AA, it's not going to be the same rehab as in Chicago. I don't care how you slice it. So he may be better off. So it makes it look kind of dodgy, but in reality, you don't know the circumstances that have gone into that injury and how long they've been kind of nursing it along.
But that's also where the agents will get involved too. The good agents will really do what's best for their player medically, and a lot of teams don't want to have the sick guys around. You get sick or injured, they want you gone. They don't want to look at you, and the better organizations and the better guys that are running teams. Joe Torre was really a gem to work with. And he was a player's guy. And if they got the best treatment there, then they were around the clubhouse. They weren't like a pariah. There are other guys that are completely different. They don't want to see you. But that's where the agents will get involved too. And then they'll say, well, listen, he's going to get better treatment here. And if you're not going to keep him up in the major league, we're going to send him down to Birmingham. He's going to stay there work with Wilk, and so that's where you lose control of your player if you don't do what's best for it all comes around to bite you. If you don't do what's best for the player, it'll get you.
Matt?
I know this is not an orthopedic question, but I was wondering if you could comment on the medical and view on concussions, which they're affecting all sports now, and baseball as well. And I know there's been a lot of attention paid, and whether you can comment on what's going on with that.
Well, concussions are probably no more now than they were years ago, but we just do a better job of recognizing them and treating them. Guys used to get dinged and continue to play. where now a player will get dinged and the athletic trainer has a better job of recognizing the concussion. The physician will be called to look at the player, and the player is more aware that there's long-term damages to concussions. We have found that in the high schools that people are getting, you know, dinged and returning to play because there's no athletic trainer there to help to stop that coach to putting that number one player back on the field. So that's kind of what I've seen with it.
There was some amazing research done. I forget who did it. Wouldn't surprise me if there was Sabre involvement with talking about Lou Gehrig and whether or not his multiple concussions had actually led to symptomology of what we're now calling traumatic encephalopathy and being misdiagnosed as ALS. And it was a pretty fascinating and frightening study. I mean, the idea that guys would go to bat without a helmet just strikes me as hockey goalies not having a mask. And it's that historic perspective. Like Ned said, I don't think the game has significantly changed in many ways. It's how we're recognizing and treating them. And the tough part about concussions is, you know, when a player like Brian Roberts gets hit, or Justin Morneau last year, yeah, it's very frustrating to see them out for an extended period of time. But 20 years from now, when we see Justin Morneau at Cooperstown maybe, or at a Twins old-timers game, and he's laughing and smiling and recognizing people, I think it goes back to that. Next question.
Over the last few years, we've seen a lot more focus on pitch counts and innings caps over the season, especially for young power arms. And my question to you guys is, what are your personal opinions on saving guys and, you know, using them more in, you know, when you're in a pennant race, like with Pineda this year, or, you know, things like the Java rules a couple years ago that didn't really turn out so great?
Yeah, I was a huge proponent of pitch counts. And to be scientific about it, I don't think that it's made any difference. I think where it makes a big difference is in youth baseball and with year-round baseball. But once they get to the majors, I haven't seen any significant difference in pitch counts. And I think it's probably natural selection. Once they get to that level, I don't think it's as much of an issue as it is when they've got developing arms, and so the volume of pitching and the year-round nature of pitching that happens these days, especially in the warm climates, that's much more important. So to answer your question, I think it's age-dependent. I think it's very, very important to pitch count your young kids. And I think it's much less important in major minor league baseball.
Kevin, I know you've been a big part of this, and yeah, your protege has been at the forefront of it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if we bring it down to youth baseball, so if you have any grandchildren or children that are playing baseball, just like Neil said, if they throw more than 100 innings in a year, they got 3.5 times greater risk of injury, shoulder or elbow. So in youth baseball, that's definitely a correlative. And probably the number one, even more so than throwing a curveball or a slider at a young age, believe it or not. The other issue, too, is, you know, with these pitch counts, what we looked at, you know, Dr. Fleissig, mm-hmm. And so what we looked at was this whole issue of playing in the South versus playing in the North. So what Glenn did not too long ago, he looked at the number of Major League Baseball pitchers, and he looked at their birthplace. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean that they actually pitched growing up, but we made an assumption. 56% of the pitchers are actually from the South. So even though they're being utilized, just like you said, there's probably a, you know, natural selection process, but the majority of baseball pitchers were actually from warmer climates.
Yeah. Following on that question, can you guys go a little bit long? Is that
sure.
Okay. I want to get those questions. We'll leave the loop back there. Why are we still using pitch counts and innings limits at the major league level instead of directly measuring fatigue and recovery periods, which are where we're really seeing the injuries?
We don't know how to do that. It's much easier to count. we haven't figured that out, but that is exactly what we should be doing with high-speed kinematics to to be able to spot a player that's going bad before he goes bad. And that is, you're 100% right. You know, with all the technology we have now, I mean, it's just up to us to get smart enough to figure out how to spot that before it goes bad. So it's a great point.
Pitching counts are misleading.
Same technology for a strike zone.
Pardon me?
Same technology for a strike zone.
Exactly. You know, there is a software program that I just saw at the end of last season.
Ricks.
Yeah, you can see where all the pitches are,
yeah.
And you can see where the ball's going as a guy fatigues. I mean, it's really amazing technology. It's just we're not smart enough to put it all together yet, but we'll get there. It's just a little behind.
You know, pitch counts are misleading, just like was mentioned, because a reliever has to warm up at a higher intensity, so especially their rest periods are much shorter between exposures. So there's a natural, problem that you have with pitch counts. You're not bringing the factor of warm-ups and high-intensity type work on the side. So,
yeah. Next question.
My question may require some speculation to answer. If Sandy Koufax were 30 years old today, what could the medical profession do to prolong his career?
He had a Tommy John. He went bad because he tore his ligament, and Frank Joe will be the first to tell you that because Sandy is a favorite of almost anybody that gets to know him, and that was one of Frank's biggest regrets, is that he didn't figure out the Tommy John before Tommy John. He wanted to have it figured out for Sandy. He would have wanted it to be called the Sandy Koufax operation. Your Honor, yeah, that's exactly right.
And if I can jump in here, this is a challenge for you guys. I know a lot of you are historical researchers. We can go back and get the box score from some 1889 game and basically reconstruct it perfectly. We can't do that with injury. There are some attempts out there to go historical. But I would love and would challenge each of you to go back and try to find who else blew out their elbow. Who were the 24-year-old guy that had pitched 200 innings and then two the next year. Putting together a list of that sort would be insanely valuable.
Who do you think the first guy was that thought of pitch counts, pitch volume, at least the first big name player who said that this is bad for my arm to throw too many pitches? Nolan Ryan. Go back in time a little bit further.
Christy Matthews, I
mean. Cy Young. Cy Young, if you look at his stats, you'll see that at that time, there was the foul ball rule wasn't in place. So a guy could go and he could foul off 100 pitches and it wasn't a strike. And so these guys were really pretty good with the bat, and they'd face a guy like Cy Young or Dizzy Dean, and so what they would do is they would just foul them off until they got a pitch they thought they could hit. And Cy Young was a master at body conditioning way before his time. If you looked at his body, I mean, he could be playing today. He was chiseled. He was a tall, strapping guy and well-muscled, but he kept himself in great shape. He prided himself on it. He never drank, didn't do tobacco. He drank water. He didn't, Anyway, there was a famous episode where a guy was up there, up at bat, and he was notorious for fouling these balls off. And so after he had done it about six or seven times, Cy Young called him to the mound. They met halfway between home plate and the mound. And he said, "Listen, I'm going to throw this next pitch right across the plate. If you foul this thing off, the next one's going right in your ear." So he understood pitch counts. He understood it could be bad for his arm.
You've mentioned the core training as sort of the specialty. Athletes are focusing more on their core muscles. Are they overdoing it, and is that leading to some of the oblique possibilities? And also, is the desensitization of the strikeouts. Strikeouts are no longer bad. Everybody's swinging for the fences. Nobody's chomping down on their swing with two strikes. Mark Reynolds still has a job. is that sort of like, you only have so many bullets in your gun, you know, swinging for the fences every time. Is that part of what may be going on here?
Ned?
I think the overemphasis of the core isn't quite looking at it correctly. It's doing the core exercises correctly, looking at keeping the lower extremities flexible, the spine flexible, especially the thoracic spine, that you just don't create a solid ridge lever with having that six-pack abs, but you gotta have, you know, as one of my friends says, you gotta have a little fat to hit the slider. So that's it.
Thank you. Sliding in head first seems to be more the norm today than when I was growing up. What kind of injury situations does that bring up? Or is that something that you really think is safer in some ways than sliding in feet first?
I've got this one. There was actually a study done by the NCAA about 6 years ago. It was done using softball. So it's not a perfect study, but it turns out that there was kind of both sides of one coin. On the one hand, there were a greater number of injuries for head-first slides in sheer number. There's sprained wrists, broken fingers, things that would keep you out a matter of, you know, maybe a game or two in some situations. Maybe, you know, in Major League Baseball, it might cost you a 15-day DL. The injuries that they saw with feet-first slides were lesser in numbers, but much more severe: broken ankles, broken toes, broken legs. You know, there were an amazing incident of compound fractures in NCAA Division III softball, so I don't know what those girls are doing. At the major league level, it looks about the same. I only have 10 years of data to work with, so it's a very low incidence. I think we're still seeing the specter of Pete Rose on that.
I guess the question that I'm going to ask is generally, you know, how did Major League Baseball do without you guys back in the, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, and all of that? But I suppose what I'm getting at in terms of that as the underlying thing is, you had mentioned, or somebody had mentioned, the idea of more torque, players using more torque right now when they're swinging the bat or pitching and things like that, which then sort of leads by implication to the idea that is there much more emphasis and much better technique and mechanics that are used by players today, both with regard to pitching and hitting, than there was in the past? And might that be sort of one of the reasons why there's at least a perception, certainly seems to me, that there are a lot more injuries taking place these days than there were back in the 40s and 50s and 60s when you had a lot of pitchers, for example, up at 290, 300 innings a year?
It'd be interesting to see what Kevin has to say, because he works with one of the greatest biomechanics guys in baseball, Glenn Fleissig. But I do think that the guys now are able to generate much more torque across the wide spectrum of players. If you take a guy that was the best speedball pitcher 50 years ago and the best speedball pitcher now, maybe the difference isn't as much, but across population of players, you get a lot more guys that are up in that real big fast category, and so I think that they are able to generate much more torque, but not all of them have the proper protective mechanics that can protect them from that torque. And so I do think that we're seeing a lot of injuries that end up either being career-ending injuries or coming to surgery because that particular player may be vulnerable because he can generate the force, but he can't protect himself from the force.
Yeah, I think that's you know, a hard question. I think there's a lot of different factors. You know, when you look at decades of life, socioeconomic as well with these athletes. So some of these people may just be perceiving a minor injury today, and they're just worried about the ramifications and maybe shutting it down. Whereas 20 years ago, you basically had to play. Your salaries weren't that high, you know. So that could come into play as well.
Give me a knuckle.
You'd be healing under that. Yeah, even you wanted to stay in the league and didn't want to have to work your second job. And so that's a factor. But I do believe, just as Neil said, there's more people as a mass generating higher torque values than ever before. And that actually transcends all the way down to a little bit younger ages. And so, I mean, it's a tissue type of issue where your tissue just can't withstand the accumulation of these forces. So eventually something's got to give. Especially if something's weak in the connection, just like we've all said before. So it could be your oblique, it could be your hip, you could tear your labrum, you could tear your cuff, UCL, wherever maybe your mechanics tend to break down probably the most. Our mindset at our center is heavily biomechanics based. So we always look at the biomechanics, what's breaking down as a result of fatigue, where's your stress. It's just like anybody, as you get tired, your posture changes. So you have breakdowns, whether it's your neck, your low back, whatever. I think the picture is basically the same.
I know I've heard Glenn talk about this. We're seeing, and just a recent one with John Lesser, who went on the DL today, strained his lat, the latissimus dorsi, one of the, it's not the largest muscle. Is that increased torque now leading to an injury we really never saw 10 years ago? I mean, Ben Sheets was really about the first one I can remember.
Peavy pulled it off.
Yeah.
Completely pulled it off. I think you see a few lats here and there, but it's such a powerful force generator. I don't know Lester's story, but you wonder if his mechanics had changed a little bit, if he had another type of problem and suddenly started to compensate. It's hard to say with a lat strain like that, though.
Yeah. Next question, we'll finish up with the next one.
Hey, I have difficulty getting as worked up about sort of performance-enhancing substances as the rest of the world. I'm curious, do you all think there is a moral or ethical line in between taking advantage of sort of surgical developments and from Tom John on down, as opposed to chemical developments and medical enhancements in that arena? Is there something sort of inherently different or worse taking advantage of one sort of development from another?
You guys have, many of you have probably read about the PRP using plasma therapy and platelet therapy. It's right now it's under debate, but it's in the Olympic circles, but it's not legal. It's considered blood doping in the Olympic medicine. And that's under discussion right now. Tennis recently is going through a change. I think they're probably going to say it's okay now for tennis. But the NFL, Major League Baseball, and basketball, it's okay. How does that differ from performance-enhancing medication? It's a really gray line. And before this little discussion was over, I was going to ask you guys, your opinion as fans, where you stand on the topic, because I don't have a more valid answer than your answer. And so what example does it set for our young people? That's something I do need to be concerned about, because I take care of people of all ages, and so what kind of effect is that going to have socially on the young athletes that we take care of? Because believe me, I see high school kids and junior high school kids that are dabbling in steroids and HGH. It's amazing, what happens. And their parents know it. And their parents, including girls, by the way.
Especially girls.
Especially girls. Girls soccer is rife with anabolic steroid use. It's amazing. But anyway, I would turn that back to you guys. Does it decrease your appreciation for an athletic performance, or your appreciation for watching a baseball game or baseball season, if you knew that your favorite player, your star hitter or whatever, was performance enhanced by HGH or steroids? I mean, how show of hands, how many people would have less enjoyment watching a game like that if you knew that your favorite players were on steroids? Well, there's your answer. I mean, it's and I'm a fan just like you guys. It does take away a bit from it for me.
Do you think that, especially stem cells, since they're controversial in society, do you think they're going to be accepted as a medical treatment, or that they're going to kind of straddle that gray line?
I think that taking the religious aspects out of it, with regard to stem cells, if you use that as a biologic way to enhance healing, I think that that's probably still on the acceptable side of the line. At least it is for me. I hope it is for other people, because I do think that that's a natural biologic way that tissues heal anyway, and you're not oversupplying something unnaturally to it. You know, for me anyway, that's on the acceptable side of the line.
No, just thank you.
And it's just my opinion.
Oh, no, I understand that. As someone who knows a few professional ball players, I think anyone who allows their children to take cues and behavior from them, steroid use may be the very least of your worries.
You know, I was tuned into this problem back in the probably the mid to late 90s, and everybody was talking about these hitters, McGuire, and everybody was saying, who knows what drugs he's taking, and I was in a unique position because I saw the pitchers come in, and I knew that it was a problem, and I'm sure that the same was with Kevin and Ned, and because they would ask me one of two questions, and the questions went like something like this: Doc, should I go on HGH to try to get better from this surgery that you're going to do on me? And so by them asking that question, that told me, number one, they were very familiar with the medication, and number two, they were very comfortable. If I would have said, yeah, I think it's a great idea, they would have gone right out, and either they said, okay, can you get some for me, or they would have gone and got it themselves. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, the more obvious question they would ask that told me what was going on was, Doc, should I go off HGH before my surgery? And these are the pictures. And then I would think back on when I was a kid, and I would watch guys like Dibble, when I was younger, I would watch these guys, Goose Gossage and stuff like that, and if they hit a batter, they made it to home plate before the batter would be able to make it to the mound. So this has been going on for a while, and the guys that we had the most fun watching were suspect, I think. So it's been prevalent. They're testing a lot more for it, and I think that you're seeing a dip in the amount of usage now. And I think that the game is just as enjoyable. I think that you may not see a guy that's going to hit as many home runs as McGuire or Bonds did, but I think it's just as fun.
Well, I don't think that's directly attributable to the game in this room. I think home runs are down simply because of.
Yeah.
That's the myriad of.
Let me ask you guys, anecdotally, I've seen players' bodies over the last 5 years change from being more, for lack of a better word, muscle-bound, the McGuire, Bonds, Sosa model, and now you see players that are just ripped. I mean, six-packs, veins popping out. Have you seen that as well? Just that if they can't do it one way, they're going to do it another? And I'm not saying illegally either way.
Yeah, I don't know. I'd like to think that there's more emphasis on training. I mean, baseball was not really a sport where you thought of, spend a lot of time in the weight room. And I think that now you see a lot of the guys, and I know on our team, Ethier is a gym rat, and Matt Kemp is in the gym. And these guys are lifting weights and working out much more than I think that probably traditionally was there. So I think that there's probably more attention paid to it. You're talking about 20-something year old guys, and their bodies respond to those kinds of workouts like that.
Kemp's built like a male model for God's sake.
And he could be great in any sport, I think.
The other aspect is not only training, but the supplements and nutrition. It's so much different today than it was 10 years ago.
the knowledge base as far as supplements to gain muscle mass and lean muscle mass. So athletes now have nutritional experts, teams do, so you're building a leaner, stronger, you know, faster machine, just like we've talked about earlier. So it's not just the training, but it's the rest, the nutrition, and so forth.
When did the Angels have a nutritionist, and at what point did you guys start that?
We have a registered dietitian named Ellen Coleman, who has probably been with us now for 20 years.
Wow, that was early.
It's the whole thing of the supplementation, the awareness of the player about what they're going to eat, what foods are provided in the clubhouse, like for a day game, you know, breakfast will be provided. And it used to be that when I first started, the breakfast was a 2 dozen donuts and a pot of coffee, and go get it. Most, if not all, of the clubhouses, they'll have a chef in there in the morning who will be cooking, you know, egg white vegetable omelets and, you know, fresh squeezed orange juice, and maybe there's 6 donuts sitting over there for the usher that, you know, stops in.
Coaches.
But, you know, it's just the whole way of thinking about it. But, you know, everybody, we would do nutritional analysis on people, and they just try to make them better.
Last 2 questions.
Hi, I'm James. I want to know about a player like Bobby, Doug DeSingsy. This is going back 33, 35 years ago, something like that, 33 years ago. He played with the Baltimore Orioles, and then he played with the Angels. And I'm going by memory. I think he was on the disabled list for about 6 or 7 months because of severe back problem, bad back, or something like that. How was sports medicine was able to rehabilitate him? And when he got on the Angels, he had 2 or 3 good seasons right away, despite having bad back from, I think, from Baltimore. How was he able to do so well? He was then about 28 to 32.
Well, we were very fortunate that Robert Watkins, who's a spine surgeon, who's now in Marina Del Rey, we used him as a consultant. He was with the Curl and Joe group. And just sitting down with him and putting together a back stabilization program so that things wouldn't move when Doug would, every time he tried to take a step, you know, he'd go into spasm. And he was, again, a very special athlete and would dedicate himself to do his exercises. And I think that's what you're seeing with a lot of professional players, high school collegiate players. They know now the benefit of doing the exercises, and we as clinicians know how to get them to do them correctly and carry over. Because, you know, if you do an exercise and you do it incorrectly, you're going to fall into a bad movement pattern and just create more problems for yourself.
Okay, thanks.
Last one.
Thanks, I'm Tom Gahagian. Just curious how much a pitcher's windup has to a long career. So I love Tom Seaver, very smooth, and you would say CC Sabathia, Roy Halladay, you know, Tommy Glavine, Greg Maddux, they all pitched an extremely long time. Does their windup or just consistency of their windup have anything to do with longevity and success?
Kevin, you want to summarize Glenn's work?
Well, as far as longevity, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Glenn does. But, you know, as far as a windup being anything more than a distraction to the hitter, that's really about all it is. And it basically aligns you in the proper position in late cocking. So whether you come out of the stretch or a windup, biomechanically, it virtually makes no difference. You know, you would think the windup, especially kids, you know, their problem is the windup. They want to catapult their body toward home plate, and it puts them in a bad balance position as far as their core or their shoulder is in space, so they tend to be leaning toward the plate. But as far as, you know, the drop and drive, you know, the legs, the hip, everything that, like, Tom Seaver talked about, for instance, in his book, you know, it made sense. Nolan Ryan was a big proponent of the legs and training the legs to drive the arm. You know, I don't really know. I don't know if anybody has the answer to that, whether or not that really improves longevity, or was this something that just worked for these individuals? And then you try to apply it to everyone, it may not actually work. Because a lot of these individuals were power pitchers, Seaver, Ryan, and so forth. So, I don't know. Ned, do you have an opinion on that?
I agree with you.
Listen, I want to thank all three panelists up here for taking the extra time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.